Okay, hi everyone. My name's Sam Barton-Nickel. I'm the Director of Product Management at Mediatonic. As such, this isn't going to be a particularly technical talk, but what I kind of want to talk to everyone about is the story behind how we've repositioned ourselves as a studio from a pay-to-hire studio to a services studio over the last 3 or 4 years. And it's been instrumental in this happening has actually been utilizing the cloud to actually get us into a position where we can make these decisions. So first of all, I kind of just want to go through what made us like think about what's happening in the gaming world and why we wanted to make those choices and move towards the cloud. And one of the things that we very early on started to notice is that there are kind of four things that were happening in the gaming world at around kind of 2011, 2012. And we wanted to make sure that we were ahead of things there. We weren't just kind of waiting for this big change to happen for everyone to move to mobile and then kind of work in a Me Too situation and kind of jump ship there. So the thing that was very, very clear to us is that having the web and having a lot of mobile devices pop up suddenly, it suddenly meant there was a huge abundance of IP available. And discovering great media became insanely easy. YouTube, for a start, has just grown and grown. And obviously, when Google acquired it and could integrate all of the search engine with YouTube, and then that being accessible on mobile devices across everyone, suddenly getting great media out of the game, out of your device, becomes insanely easy. And there are multiple ways of doing it. At the same time, and this is something that's very important, still an ongoing concern to a lot of people in the industry, is that the volume of IP creates price dilution. We've seen this race to the bottom, as it's often called with games, and this is where the free-to-play market has come very much out of this this area. And not just that, but also we're starting to see it with the music and film areas as well. So in any kind of industry where the cost to create an incremental of something is zero, so it doesn't actually cost any more to create another version of your game once you've built all the code. You'll always see the economy push it down to across zero. So again, this was a second thing that we noticed in this time. Also, this was something that actually blindsided us a bit, and owning media as stuff became unimportant. I mean, there's still a lot of people out there who probably love their DVD collections and things like that. But if you look at what Spotify's doing, if you look at what Netflix are doing, or Amazon, as what they've done since they've taken over Love Film, we'll see that actually people are becoming less and less attached to the media that they're buying. They're quite happy to pay a subscription fee and have access to those movies. But once that subscription fee runs out, there's not a lot of angst about, oh, well, I haven't got that stuff that I paid for anymore. And actually, side on this is that consumers actually have started to have minimal loyalty. And MySpace, it's a bit of an old example, this one, but it just shows that as soon as the kind of the new kid on the block in any kind of media age turns up, then if the service is better, if they're offering something that someone else, users will just flip straight to that better service without a thought of the years or the time that they've spent in the past. So these were these kind of four key pillars that we noticed that were going on at the same time. We thought, so how can we kind of put a solution together and move ourselves kind of towards where we can see the industry going, away from this kind of work to hire situation that we're currently in, where we're very much working, making kind of like retail-based games that they're out and we kind of launch them and then forget about them. And so to answer these four pillars, we came up with these four strategic points that we try and answer and that we continue to try and still answer today. And these are discovering, you know, great media is easy. So the answer to that is be everywhere. Make sure that you're on every single video channel, you're on every single platform, every single market across the world. There's so much option out there that if you want to be seen and be recognized, you need to be on all of those options. Likewise, when the price dilution is in place and that you're seeing that your costs are very close to zero, you need to lower the barrier to entry to actually get into the games there. Because what happens is if you're putting a lot of money up front in creating a game and that you're not quite sure how it's going to do, then you're putting yourself in a very risky position. So making sure that we can get games out at minimal cost, and it also increases the chance we'll have a hit because that we can do more of them. But at the same time, it makes sure that we're not in a position where something goes wrong and then the studio is in dire straits because of it. Going beyond products is something that we've seen across all kind of media at the time, in that because stuff is important, you've got to make sure that your service that you're providing is an ongoing thing. We don't want a game to be something that a person plays kind of just once and then walks away from and then that's gone out of their lives. If we provide kind of an ongoing experience for that people. People can work a game into their schedule, work a game into their lives, and then it becomes a living, breathing, kind of diverse world out there that they can be interested in and continue to be interested in over a long period of time. And also, because consumers have minimal loyalty, it is doubly important that you don't make something because you think it's a good idea, launch it and forget about it. You have to listen and respond and have the power to listen to and respond to all of your users as well. So having these things in place, one of the things that we asked ourselves is how can the cloud be used to solve these challenges? And the answer to that was it took us a good year to come up with a solution, but we created a system called GameFuel, which is basically a live management platform. And I'll touch on some of these points in a bit more detail, but essentially what GameFuel allows us to do is we can instantly publish and change our games via the cloud. We can scale up and down to have millions of active players online at the same time. It's a full content management system solution, so we can change the game as we want. Lets us rapidly localize across all the different markets in the world. It lets us have an art pipeline that separates artists from engineers. And it lets us do big data analytics. So at the moment, GameFuel actually allows us to do less with more. And that's kind of the key takeaway from how we can use the cloud and GameFuel to help us solve all of those issues that I mentioned. So at the moment, each month, we have kind of 50 million plus requests. We publish up to 20 updates over multiple games, and that is to players in 36 different territories across the world and growing pretty much every week. So diving into a bit more detail on those particular pillars, being everywhere, we wanted to tackle head-on in terms of cross-platform. So this was touched on a little bit earlier, but one thing that we found very important is to make sure that we're separating the client-side development from the logic that's sitting in the cloud. So basically, we have on each of our devices, we share a programming language where possible, but that's not always possible. So we try to have a client-side wrapper, something like HTML5 or Unity across all of our games. But then actually, all of the elements and the logic about the games is controlled centrally up in the cloud. And so the content is separated from the code, and you can have different people working on those two things with different language skills and making sure that you're tailoring the game to the device, and so everything is working optimally. So what that allows us to do is have seamless instant updates to any device that we choose to launch a game on, and also operate as a service, which means we're free from approvals. It makes things secure, so it's much harder to cheat, and it's completely dynamic at the same time. So a good example of one of these was we've been working with Activision on having the collection vault for Skylanders games. And so obviously there has to be, Activision's got such a broad reach with those games, and the people playing those games have a huge different number of devices. So we utilize this tool to be able to have the game client unique to whether it's Facebook or Windows or Apple devices or a browser or Android, but keeping all the logic in as of how it works and all the content of how the collection vault works in the cloud at the same time. So every time we made an update there, we didn't need to touch the client code again. So as well as platforms, we wanted to make sure that we could be in as many markets as possible as well. And so GameFuel and the cloud use of that lets us serve different content based on territory. It lets us adjust for the demographics in those different places because we work quite a lot with Eastern developers, Square Enix at the moment. And one thing that we noticed that there's actually a large difference in how Eastern consumers play with games and how Western consumers play with games. And so having market-specific logic in the cloud lets us change how the game acts to those different markets so we can get the best possible commercial return. But at the same time, just a bit more down to earth, it also lets us cut a lot of the work from translation. So the tool allows us to do bulk imports, exports, and testing on the localization of language. Regionalization is also a big thing. We're working with Disney and their Superbia web game at the moment, and because that reach is so great with Disney property, they're actually this game is live in most of the different languages available at the moment across Europe and America. And with actually a click of a button, we can have all of the game in GameFuel, export it, translate it, import it, validate it, and publish it all just using GameFuel without any input from engineers on the client side. So seamless updates is probably the thing that kind of sets it up the most, sets our game fuel aside from the traditional way of doing this the most, because what allows us to do is separate the approval processes involved with Apple, which can be quite lengthy, and lets us do this in a way that doesn't impact a player while they're actually playing through the game. So essentially the process is a player will download the game from the store, they will play it locally, or it may be an online game, but they're playing on their local client. In the background, the game is checking game fuel for updates. If it finds any, then it downloads the updates from the cloud, usually while a player is actually actively playing the game, and then updates it without a player actually ever knowing that an update has been downloaded. And so it's secure because it's all authenticated by the server. We're minimizing the downtime. We don't need to have maintenance times. We don't have to tell players, well, the game's going to be down for this time, because it always happens in the background. And as we said, if we want to make a release on a Monday, and then we decided the response to something that we've seen, we want to do it on a Tuesday as well, and then a Wednesday as well, we can do that without having to resubmit the client to the platform holder and go through their 1 to 2 week waiting processes for that to happen. So that kind of covers off our be everywhere pillar. Going beyond products is something that links quite closely into that. So item management is one thing that we can do with GameFuel, which means that on the fly we can change, add or remove items that are in the game at any given point. Also doing level and quest editing is something that is we can do on the fly as well. And here's just an example of a game that we've been working with Microsoft for called Secret and Treasure. And this shows this is what our designers work with. So this is their level development tool. And what's nice about this is that they can use this tool, they can move around how the level works. It's actually a pachinko style game. And make a decision on, well, I want to change this, I want to change this. Once they save this, it packages it all up in a JSON file, which we can then upload to GameFuel. And using that seamless process, new levels can be transferred and changed to a client without having to go through any approval processes, or in fact, without actually having an engineer touch it at all. So listening and responding is a very important part, especially part of my job as product manager, director. And we use the cloud and Azure specifically for a lot of this, and this is kind of like a vital day-to-day process that we go through. So this is about as technical as this talk gets, but essentially we have our logging servers that every time a user plays the game, it stores all of their tracking information about what they're doing within a game. And then it will upload it to Azure and put it in a queue once there's the connection to the internet there. This all happens behind the scenes to a user again. It writes the logs, it's stored as blobs, it's processed using HD Insights and then into a reporting database based on MS SQL. So what that allows us to do is have every day we come into the office in the morning, we've already automatically had processed a whole suite of reports where we can go away and have a look at how the game's been working for the last day. At the same time, we have a virtual machine running a real-time data system, and this is more used for emergencies, so we can keep an eye on certain things. If we've launched a new event in a game or if we put a new level in, we like to be able to keep an eye as it goes live just to make sure there are no issues from it. But what both of these means is that we can produce executive metrics on a daily basis, both for us and for our publishers. And so we can have a look at all the things that allow us to make changes and decisions about the game. On both a user side, whether you know the game is fun, whether people are sticking around to play it, whether there are certain points of the game where people are becoming stuck, whether there's levels that have a huge drop-off rate that we know there's an issue to approach on them. But also on the commercialization of it, we can see, are we making money? Where are we making the money from? Are we pushing this certain item enough? Is this too aggressively monetized? So this is all kind of a requests from kind of the executive team at Mediatonic to look at this stuff. But on the other side of that, we also have professional data scientists and analysts working with this data at all given times. So sometimes they'll, through their processes, which I've described a few here, will come to us and say, hey, I've spotted something that may prove an opportunity for us commercially. And we'll go away and we'll have a look at that. And often based on this information coming back to us, we can make a decision on the game and then actually seamlessly put that into play and then come back the next day or look real time to see if we've seen an improvement there. And big data analysis, again, is just something that we're very big on. This is a bit of an iteration of the last slide, but essentially what happens is the game events happen. They're all sent to their individual logging servers, which are sent up to the cloud. We use an ETL process to process all of that data, which goes into our data warehouse and then into our reporting software. And this happens regularly throughout the day, and we do a larger batch process overnight. And what this really allows us to do is just tuning based on player activity. It lets us see what players are doing, all of our players, and look at that and decide what's best for the game, what's the best for our majority of players. But not just our majority of players, because of the system, how it works, we can actually say, well, this group of players act like this in the game, would benefit from this. This player's act like this, and would maybe react better to a certain thing. And so we can actually split those off and provide different content to different players based on what we're seeing in their activity. So this is kind of an example of this. This is a game that we published with Adult Swim called Delivery Outlaw. It's a side-scrolling racing game on mobile. And the visualization that the having the data come back to us can let us do is we can take a level like this, which a designer may be very used to seeing, and overlay data around where people are failing within this game using heat maps. So we can see all the different reasons why a player fails a level here laid on top of it. And then what this allows us to do is, without using an engineer, we can, again, send this straight back to our level designers, and they can see each of the levels in the game at any given time and see if players are actually reacting to those levels in the way that they imagine them to be. And it may be that there's a balance issue here, that too many players are falling down a pit at a certain level and they didn't expect that, and that's why the level's too hard. Or players are getting through it without too much trouble and actually it's too easy for that point in the game. And once again, we can look at this and we can make changes and we can seamlessly update it so a player doesn't actually ever know that there's been an update there, but we can tweak the game to provide the best possible experience for them and the best commercial return for us. And I brushed on this a bit lightly earlier, and segmentation is a thing too. So as we said, people in different regions in the world react differently to different game mechanics. For example, pay to win is a kind of a very dirty word over here in the West, but actually when we've released games in Japan and China, we've actually heard back complaints that there weren't any ways that players could actually pay money to like get ahead in the game, and it's a much more socially acceptable thing over there. So using the segmentation, we can actually provide two different versions of the game, two different monetization options, and put them in the game depending on where the game is being played. Likewise, within a certain region, we can also split by behavior. So if new players are experiencing something in the game that is not something that we want to expose to a player who's been playing the game for 6 months, we can do that as well. We can add some complexity into the game for our veteran players while not lumping our early game players with certain parts of the game that perhaps aren't interesting to them yet. And it also allows us to do multivariate testing as well. So we can change a number of things and see the combination of their effects at any given time on our user base. This is just a kind of a breakdown of what I was just saying about how we can split the different game characteristics, whether it's based on a user behavior or if it's based on how they're commercially interacting with the game. And essentially what this all lets us do is build a virtual economy, which is something that we really like to do with all of our games because it gives us so many levers and pulleys that we can tweak and change and make the best possible game for our users, and gives us the most possible options to do that while we're moving on. And the listening and responding pillar actually is very key to the lower barrier to entry. And because what a data-driven design process lets us do is it lets us centralize all of the game properties and values and data, so it's all in the cloud together, and combine that with the user data that we're getting in real time, and have the whole design process around a game being very analytical. That doesn't mean that we rule out creativity, because we hold creativity very strongly in the studio, but what it does is it lets us go back to the creative minds in the studio with actual facts. They may be asking us questions about, you know, I'm not sure if a player wants this or likes this or wants this, and then we can actually get back to them with information to help them make a decision about where they want to take the game. But also what it does is it removes a lot of the risk out of guesswork there and kind of putting the whole success of a game on the back of one or two of the creative minds on the studio who feel that they've spotted a gap in the market. And likewise, it allows us to manage many work streams at the same time. Because the logic is all in the cloud, it lets us split out things like major features, weekly updates, bug fixes, and tutorial tweaks and hot fixes, and lets our engineers all work on them separately before the builds emerge and the conflicts are resolved. later on in the process. So it kind of splits out this independency between engineers within the studio working on different parts of the games. We tend to have a development team which are very much working on what's the next big update in the game, what's the big change, what's the thing that the players are going to see, and a separate team kind of working as live ops, fixing bugs, doing balance tweaks, things like that. And this allows the two to work side by side without having a lot of independency to rely on each other and end up waiting for the other team to finish their work before another one can move on. The instant publishing also helps lower the barrier to entry as well, because it doesn't require engineering, as I said earlier, for having content updates or tweaks to balance. It also lets us have all the development branches merge into one, and with just one click we can deploy onto a staging, and another click we can also deploy onto live. But what's probably more important to us is rollback as well, because no kind of game development is without its problems. And there are occasions where we've put things live and we've immediately seen a problem and a game-breaking bug or something, or a level that players simply can't get past. And traditionally, if we were waiting for if we were working everything on the client side, we would have to wait for the two-week Apple approval process, or cross our fingers and hope that Apple expedited one of our requests to put a new build through and fix it like that. However, as soon as we see that process go wrong now through our live data, we can just do one click to roll back and go back to the previous best state of the game, work on solving the problem, and then going back to live again. This creates minimal fuss for the users, and it lets us spend a lot less time panicking and worrying about what's happening. But all in all, it kind of reduces our engineering costs, and that's the key thing, really, that the cloud has let us do. It lets us have GameFuel as this central position in whatever we do and split out all of the different stakeholders that require information from it. So people working on the economy, doing the writing, the game design, setting up the regional variances, or looking at the business intelligence. But also lets us split out artists and engineers from each other as well, so they can each work independently on the game without having to rely on the others or wait for the others. And a good example of this is, again, back to Delivery Outlaw, where we set up a system where our level designers could actually create levels using Adobe Illustrator. So they would just set up the levels like this, use that tool to create them, and again, once they saved those games, it would save it into a game file, JSON, that they could import straight into the game without actually requiring an artist to then go and add all of the art bits into the game, or an engineer to actually plug all the information in. And so it just basically de-risks all of the processes that we go through on a daily basis to reduce the cost to us and allow us to react much quickly to market forces or any issues that we come across. So I've gone across a few of these points before, but just I'll just reiterate through them quickly. It lets us, using the cloud, lets us share one code base across many platforms when it comes to the logic. It lets us quickly expand to new markets and new languages within those markets. It allows us to deliver content as a service rather than a product, so it's an always changing, always interesting to a user. It minimizes our team sizes and allows interdependence between them. We can scale up less expensively and gather real-time analytics. Be able to cohort our content to make sure it's addressed at the right people. And it lets us fail fast, but not the first time, because it means that if something goes wrong, we can change the game without putting that game down to a disaster. So coming back to kind of the original area of the game, I'm saying that this made us change, and the use of the cloud and GameFuel let us change our studio from a work-to-hire studio to a games-as-a-service studio. And that's because we still keep our traditional studio fundamentals. We haven't dropped any of those. So we have a creative-led design team. We have art and production pipelines, client-side engineering and production management and QA. But what we've actually managed to do now with the help of the cloud is layer all of these things on top of it. So we have games as a service technology. We can scale. It's secure. We're efficient. And we can manage the content remotely. We can do it with our live ops teams. We can, through the cloud management and the monitoring and the deployment, we can do that actively all the time without being reliant on third-party platforms. We can use big data and business intelligence to help with product strategy and decide what's the best for the market and move quickly on that at any given time. But it also lets us look in things like user acquisition and distribution and community, which are becoming increasingly important in the games we're seeing. So not only has this allowed us to change, but it's also let us hire in new people working in new areas within the studio. So now we have whole teams based on product strategy, on server-side engineering, business intelligence, and DevOps. So pretty much that's my story. I just want just reiterating the whole thing, we were in a pretty uncomfortable place about 3 or 4 years ago when we could see the start, the mobile gaming explosion and the casual gaming explosion start to happen. And I think without kind of this movement that we made towards using the cloud to help us move into a position where we can react much quicker and reduce the risk and the cost on getting games out, I think we'd be in a worrying place still. So thank you for listening, everyone. And if there's any questions, happy to take them.
Superb, Sam. Thanks for that. Really interesting stuff, actually. Any questions, anybody?
Great talk, thanks. You outlined this these four pillars at the beginning, and you had these strategic insights about those. And that was 3 or 4 years ago. So I'm wondering, is there another pillar maybe emerging that you've recognized, or can you speculate about an interesting new trend that might influence your business strategy in the future?
I wouldn't say there's a new pillar. I'd say that we've seen some of those pillars probably dominate more than some of the others. Let's just see if I can get that one back on the screen so we can see what people are talking about. Sure. Okay, so I think what we've actually seen is that the listen and respond has actually probably grown more than we thought it would. The kind of the community aspect of games has kind of skyrocketed. And I think that around that, I think what we're anticipating over the next year or so is to see the social aspects of games, and especially mobile games, kind of soar to a new level. Especially because think games are like starting to become popular with things like in-game chat for mobile games. Co-op is becoming a really hot topic as well as games that we've already got out that have kind of competitive, live competitive PvP aspects are going big. So with all of those aspects, being able to kind of listen and respond to the user base has become more important, because before each user was kind of an individual on their own. But as soon as you start allowing them to talk with each other and create communities with each other, that community aspect becomes a lot more powerful than just a lot of individuals on their own. So we're always looking at our kind of data, and we've got kind of economists working on that kind of thing as well to make sure that not only are we having kind of a game solution where, well, we've got most of the population happy and that's the best that we can do, but we're actually trying to please everyone in playing the game and offer different content based on what kind of player they are. The lower barrier to entry one is also one that is obviously a hot topic, with obviously free-to-play being a big topic about that. I think that there's been a lot of talk recently over the last 6 months around, is free-to-play kind of over now? Are customers starting to wise up and we'll go back towards a premium gaming model? And actually, I think that there's a lot of smoke and mirrors with that stuff, and a lot of people saying that are kind of talking wishful thinking about that we'll all suddenly go back to this wonderful premium $35 game, and I don't think we'll go that way. But I think we'll actually see free-to-play be done more ethically, perhaps. I think people will kind of wise up and work that. One thing I always say a lot, and my whole office is sick of it, is that every monetization has to be done with like a smile on the face of the user. They should come away with it with a sense of delight. So I think we'll see more games actually honing in on that and being able to produce delight from people while they're monetizing on it. Actually, your question, I think that these four pillars, as we see it, are still very strong, and they're still pretty much the cornerstones of what we're doing on a daily basis. That isn't to say that there aren't kind of other aspects that you should look at out there, but we very much see these as the four issues still.
Great, thanks.
Any other questions? So I've got one for you, Sam. So sure. On the second to last slide, you showed where Mediatonic is today in terms of roles and responsibilities as such. So have you seen a massive change in your studio? I noticed one of the areas was DevOps. Now, 3 years ago, did you have a DevOps team, or is that something quite new?
Yeah, no, it is completely new. We've actually built a lot of the DevOps teams and stuff from scratch in the last 2 or 3 years. We've actually created a satellite studio out in Brighton now, which is where we've kind of all of our specialists with regards to game fuel and for server-side engineering are all together. So they're almost act like almost like an internal consultant for us. So whenever we need kind of the live ops stuff and the DevOps stuff in there, that's where we go to. So I mean, a whole new kind of studio for us is a huge thing. So we've seen it explode there. But yes, there has been kind of a big change because the studio used to be dominated by kind of client-side engineers and artists who had a huge amount of independency with each other. And so a lot of there would be a lot of frustration in terms of, well, I can't get on with my work because I'm waiting for this person to finish this. And actually what we've seen is that moving this way, it lets us actually slim down on the client side. And on the side, alongside that, we managed to kind of up on things like the server-side engineers, but also on a lot of strategic stuff too. So we have more people looking at data and analyzing data and helping us find our way in the world as in the market as well. So yeah, it's been a huge shift actually, but it's all the more interesting for it because now instead of having like kind of one or two disciplines within our studio, we've got six or seven different disciplines with everyone spreading a whole kind of different amount of knowledge and on different things in there. So it's actually become a more vibrant place because of it, I think.
Any other questions? I have to ask, do you calculate what your price per user is from all this data and analytics?
We do, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a very instructive KPI for us.
All right, so it's an actual measure that, as a studio, you're individually measured on as well?
Yes.
Interesting stuff. So thank you. Thanks, Sam.
Thanks.